All right, we're ready for Genesis chapters 20 to 22 in our study. This is the outline we are following, and we are in the second major section of the patriarchal history. We're talking about Abraham, and we'll soon be into the section on Isaac. We'll see his birth in our study tonight, and more about Isaac a little bit later. Let's quickly review our chapters of where we've been. Chapter 1 is creation, 6 days of creation. Chapter 2, man in the garden. Very good. Chapter 3 is fall of man. Yes, Adam and Eve sin. Chapter 4, all right, Cain and Abel. Chapter 5, genealogy. We want to skip over that chapter, but it's a very important chapter. 6 through chapter 9 deal with the flood. So we have several things about the flood. Chapter 6 was reason and preparation. Chapter 7, the flood itself. Chapter 8, all right, very good. Chapter 9, God's covenant, the rainbow, and Noah's drunkenness. Chapter 10, yes, the nations that came from Noah's sons. Chapter 11, Tower of Babel. Chapter 12, a notable chapter, promise to Abraham. Chapter 13. Yeah, they return to Canaan, that's where they separate. Chapter 14. War among the kings, and that's where Abram had to go rescue Lot. Chapter 15, another notable chapter. All right, yeah, he's assured of the covenant. Chapter 16. These people are going to be in our story tonight. Hagar and Ishmael, chapter 17, circumcision given as a sign. Chapter 18, last time, 3 men visit with 2 announcements. And then chapter 19, very notable because that's where something major happened. Yeah, destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. All right, question number 1 for tonight. Chapter 20, what's it about? Abimelech takes Sarah. We'll talk about who he is, where he's located, and what's going on about all of that in just a moment. All right, let's look at 4 things that happened in this chapter. First, we have Abimelech took Sarah thinking that she was Abraham's sister. Look at the first 7 verses. That Abraham journeyed there to the south. Your translation may use another word, which is simply a word for the south, headed toward Egypt. That's the idea. And he dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and sojourned to Gerar. Well, let's see where that is. This region here in this general region is what's referred to as the south. We've come across that before. This is the way to Shur. And here we are at Gerar. That's where we're talking about. Abram has been located around Hebron. We're going to see him before we get through. He's going to settle in at Beersheba. And that's where he'll be for some years as we leave him at the end of chapter 22. But when we talk about kings, we think of kings as of a great territory. But there often were kings of a city. And then there'd be a king of another city and a king of another city. So he is a king of this region, maybe bigger than just the city. But this is where Abraham goes, and he runs into Abimelech. So let's see what happens now when he comes to Abimelech. At verse 2, Abram said concerning his wife, she is my sister. Now we'll see why that's true a little bit later. When did we see this once before? When he went to Egypt in chapter 12, if you want to take note of that, you remember he said, because this seems to be referenced in this context of Genesis chapter 20, that he had said, I'm paraphrasing, of course, when we struck out on our journeys that God sent us on, I told her she's going to have to tell people that she's my sister or they're going to kill me. Well, we saw that back in Genesis chapter 12, beginning at verse 10. So Abimelech took her, and he sent and he took her. Well, that's not uncommon. You think in our Western world, you would go and try to woo someone to and date them and see if they're interested in you. But that's not the case. he goes and he seizes her to be a part of his harem. And so he is not looking for a single wife. This is one, a woman that's going to come into his harem and be one of his wives, or I take that it's going to be one of his wives, or at least a concubine. But I take it he's looking for another wife. And so now notice at verse 3, what does God do? All right, God appeared to him in a dream. Now, this is not just a dream that you have when you happen to fall asleep. This is a divinely guided dream. God caused him to have a dream and tells him in the dream. So this is one of the ways that God, a vision, by the way, is one who would be awake, and God causes them to see this in the dream. God's telling them the same kind of message in a dream. You've taken another man's wife. Well, we have a question, I think we do. What do we learn about marriage here? We learned something at, that's question number two. What do you learn so far about marriage? And we've only got to verse two. To take another man's wife. This is a universal law since the beginning, that God's law was you've got somebody else's wife and you don't have a right to her. This is Abram's wife. But Abimelech defended that saying that will you not... Notice, and you might underline this because this is going to be important. We're going to tie this with verse 6 and then verse 16 a little bit later. But at verse 4, the text says he had not come near her. That means he has not yet had sexual relations with her. And God's going to prevent that from happening, as we're going to see. And so God asked him, would you slay a righteous nation also? In other words, this is going to bring condemnation down on me and my nation and my people. And so he considered his people righteous. I take it that Abimelech is a man who has some degree of fear of God. And we're going to make a point about that later on. He seems to do whatever God tells him to do. He seems to have respect for God. Later on, he tells Abraham that God's with you, and he recognized that. We'll say more about that here in just a second. So why does he describe this nation as a righteous nation, or the people that he's governing, when later on God destroys them because of their wickedness? I think their wickedness has not become full yet. We'll see that expression later in the Old Testament. God waits for it to get full. And so are there wicked people in his nation? Certainly they probably were. But he considered it not as ungodly as other cities or nations like Sodom and Gomorrah. Make sense? And so Abram is going to a little bit later assume this is no better than Sodom. And we'll see that's not a correct assumption. We'll get to that here in a second. And then he said at verse 5, in my defense, I'm going to paraphrase, they both told me that. He told me it was his sister, and she herself told me that was her brother. And so in my innocence, in the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this. That I acted on this thinking they were telling me the truth about that. And so, verse 6, God again appears to him in a dream and tells him what? All right. Yes, I know you did this in integrity of heart. I know you were innocent in that. And I mean, but I have withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, there's two things I want to point out at verse 6. One is it was still wrong for him to have another man's wife, even though he was ignorant in the process. Does that make sense? Even though he was ignorant in that, he still didn't have the right to another man's wife. God didn't say, well, you were ignorant of that, and so I'm going to let you keep her. She can be your wife. No, that's not the case at all. But here's the more important thing I want you to see. God said, I did not let you touch her. In other words, I've restrained you from that. How did God do that? We don't know for sure. Let's drop over to verse 17. I think there's a hint at verse 17, probably through some sickness that God may have caused. Because when this is all said and done, now some time has passed. I'll get to that in a moment, evidence of that, of the time passing. But God heals Abimelech. Heals him of what? I don't know. There seems to have been some sickness. So it may have been a sickness or disease or something that he had that would cause him and prevent him at that moment from cohabitating with Sarah. So God said, I have kept you from that. Now, God did some more things there that we're going to see a little bit later. What else did God do? Let's get ahead of ourselves. Verse 18, what did God do when this all took place? all of Abimelech's family, he had closed up the wombs of all the women. And God's going to take care of that a little bit later. So now at verse 7, to finish that first section, he said, restore the wife to him. He's a prophet. And so in that he's a prophet, I want you to go to him and I want you to have him do what? Pray for you. And so that you will not die. Now notice verse 3 and verse 7 in that section. When God talks to him, he sandwiches all the information between two warnings. In other words, you touch her and you're a dead man. And so you go ask him to pray for you that you may not die. Make sense? All right. Now, let's notice verse 8 through 10. That's a quick section. By that, I simply mean there's one thing accomplished. Abimelech goes to Abraham and says what? Why on earth did you do this to me? Have I offended you? Did I do something wrong to you? Tell me what I did to cause you to do all of this against me. This ought not to be done to anybody, verse 9. And what did you have in view when you did this? Now the third section on our screen, verses 11 to 13, what did Abraham say? Here's what I thought. He didn't say there's no fear of God. He said, surely I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they'll kill me on the count of my wife. Now, let's stop and analyze that for a moment. Let's assume he's right. Is that true, that if there is no fear of God, they'd just probably soon kill him as not? Yeah. Because fear of God, all through the Old Testament, Nehemiah 5 makes this point. Leviticus makes this point. Several passages in Deuteronomy will make this point. That the fear of God means you treat other people right because you respect God and His Word. And so Abraham is right. If they don't fear God, they may do me wrong. They may just soon kill me as not kill me. So they can have you. But here's the other thing I want you to notice. Abraham's assessment about Gerar was absolutely wrong. His assumptions about Abimelech were absolutely wrong. There's something practical in that. He said, I thought surely the fear of God's not in this place and they'll kill me, so we lied about that. Now, was he justified in the lie? No, that's not, and I'm not even going to go there because we've already talked about that in chapter 12. That they both lied about that and they were wrong in lying. So we'll just move on from that point. But he said, I lied because I just thought that there was no fear of God in this place. Perhaps he's thinking this city is no better than Sodom or Gomorrah, other cities he'd seen. I don't know. But he was wrong about that. Let's go back to verse 4. Abimelech thought his nation was righteous. He converses with God and doesn't argue against God. But when God tells him to go to Abraham, what does he do? He went and did exactly what God said. So at verse 4, verse 14, he restored Sarah, his wife, to him. He came and to Abraham, wanted Abraham to pray for him, and he wanted to be reconciled with God. And so what I'm trying to demonstrate to you is, and then later in chapter 21, is it 21? And in verse 22, yeah, that he said, God is with you in all that you do. So he did fear God. And so Abraham was wrong in his assessment. Right in his principle, he was wrong in his application. Does that make sense? I learned something from that I can make an assumption about people that's absolutely wrong. I can assume they don't have any respect for God or His Word, and that's just the way it is because I know of other people, maybe in their family, that are, but that doesn't mean that's the case. Abraham was absolutely wrong about his assumption, and I can be too. Make sense? For some reason, I have missed that point before. I focused at verse that there is no fear of God in this place, but he was wrong about that assumption. Maybe you caught that every time. I've kind of missed it, or if I did, I forgot I caught it. So that's part of the beauty of getting older. You learn again because you forgot what you learned before. Now, back in chapter, you might make a marginal note at verse 13 to see chapter 12 and verse 12. And because chapter 12 and verse 12 gives the reason for him saying the things that he does, that he said, I told her wherever we went, you're going to say, I'm your brother. All right. Now then, let's go to verse 14 through 18. Abimelech and Abraham bless each other. So now what happens here? Abraham brings sheep and oxen and female and male servants and gave them, or Abimelech did, and brought them to Abraham, and he restored Sarah. So he brings gifts, and he brings Sarah back and returns her, which was the right thing to do. And he makes a deal with Abraham, saying, well, dwell wherever you want to. And verse 16 is the more difficult verse. He brought 1,000 pieces of silver. That's probably in weight, not 1,000 shekels or 1,000 coins. Probably coinage was not probably one of the things by this point, but nonetheless, it probably had to do with weight. And so I brought this amount, a large amount, that's the point we want to get, of silver. And he says this to Sarah, indeed this vindicates you before all who are with you and before others. Thus she was, the New King James says, reproved. I think the English Standard kind of enhances that a little bit. If I might find that right quick. Genesis 20, and what verse was, we're looking at verse 16. That it says, behold, I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone you are vindicated. I think that's the point. I want to read that again. But let me tell you what it's saying, and then you'll get that from the English Standard. That I think his point is, I'm trying to give proof that you are innocent. You haven't done anything wrong. We have not had sexual relations. And so I'm making an agreement and a covenant by giving these 1,000 pieces of silver to your brother, the one you said was your brother, and so that you are indeed vindicated in the presence of all. Does that make sense? Let me begin to read the English Standard of verse 16. Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone you are vindicated. I like that. You might make a marginal note at verse 16 to check the English Standard. That'll enhance your understanding of that, I think. Now, at verse 17, what did Abraham do? Exactly what God said ought to be done. Prayed for him. And somebody have their hand up. Yeah. It may be kind of a gig to her over the one you said was your brother. I don't know. I wonder why.
I've read it.
Yeah. I don't know why he used the term brother instead of husband. And it may be, but it may be a kind of a gig at him, at her, that you told me it was your brother, so I'm giving it to the one that you said was your brother. We skipped over verse 12. Before I get to verse 18, I want to close out with some things at verse 18 on that chapter. That the truth of the matter is, she's a half-sister. But was it a lie? Well, yeah, it was a lie because it was intended to deceive. She is my sister. Yes, she's my half-sister, but it was intended to deceive. He's trying to say she's not my wife. That's really what he's trying to say. I don't want you to think she's my wife, because if you knew that, you'd kill me, he thought. And so she is indeed a half-sister. Now, notice, yes, ma'am.
In verse 13, Abraham words it says, this is the kindness you must do to me. And then he proceeds to tell her the Lord. He phrases the sin as if it's a good thing. Because of kindness.
Where are you? Verse 13? Yeah, verse 13. Yes, yes, I see what you're saying, yeah. He did, yeah. Yeah, I think that's, and that's what he had said over in chapter 12, in verse 12. I think that's a good point. Let's go to verse 18, and the text of verse 17 and 18. When Abraham prayed, God healed Abimelech. I think that implies that he has had some sickness. Again, there's some conjecture here, that perhaps that's how he prevented him from having the relationship with her. And then also, he had opened the wombs because they'd been closed because of Sarah. Now, what verse 18 implies to us is some time has passed in the events of this chapter. Just a cursory reading of chapter 18, you would think Abraham went there, they took his wife, and within a few hours or the next day or two or three days or within a week, they discover through this dream that this is Abraham's wife, and so we got to get this thing all settled. He takes her back, but that's not the case. Some time has passed because there had been evidence apparently that the womb had been closed for these women. And some time has passed that it's evident this man has some sickness that needs to be, or disease or something that needs to be healed. And so how much time, you say? I don't know. But there was enough time had passed that it was evident to them that their wombs had been closed because of Sarah, and now God heals that. Does that make sense? How long? I don't know. The text doesn't say. All right. Chapter 21, what's it about? Birth of Isaac. All right. Now, in the birth of Isaac, we have three things that happen here. Isaac is born, and then Hagar and Ishmael are sent away. And now we come back to Abimelech. We're not through with him. This whole section, chapter 20 and 21, is about Abimelech and his connection. But we have the birth of Isaac inserted here. Now, by the way, back in chapter 20, I think the point of chapter 20 seems to be demonstrating that any dealings that they had with Abimelech, that there was no relationship between Sarah. So when a child is born later, whenever that happens, however long that is, it's not Abimelech's child. Does that make sense? That seems to be the point of chapter 20. Otherwise, why do we need to know about Abimelech? We need to know about him so that we're assured that this child is the birth of Abraham's son. All right. Now, verses 1 to 7, we have the birth of Isaac. The Lord visited Sarah as he had spoken, for she conceived at the set time of which the Lord had spoken to him. Three times, there's assurance, just like God had said, this would take place. Now, you might make a reference, marginal note, 17 and 21, chapter 17, verse 21, and 18 and verse 10. I'll give those again. Those are where God had said, a year from now, or at the set time, you're going to have a child. 17 and 21, and 18 and 10. 17, 21, 18, 10. All right? Now, when the child is born, he called his name Isaac because that means he laughed. Laughter. And Abraham had the son, and he had him circumcised when he was 8 days old, just as God had commanded. That's 17 in verse 17, where God had commanded that. How old is Abraham when this takes place? He's about 100 years old. So just a little chronology here. About 2,100 years since the creation. I think Klassen says 2108. Others will say 2,066 years. I'm not interested in the exact chronology because I'm not sure we can be. But I'm following Klassen. So Klassen, I think, is the one who said 2,108. So approximately 2,100 years since Adam. About 500 years, and that's an approximate time. I believe Klassen says 502 to be more exact, he thinks, since the flood. So we're about 500 years from the flood, 2,100 years from creation. Abraham is 100 years old. Now, Sarah said God made her laugh. This time she's using it in the sense of rejoicing, I think in verse 6. And who would have thought that Sarah would have nursed children? I might underline children. Make some use of that a little bit later. Not tonight, but we will at another time. All right. Now let's start at verse 8. Hagar and Ishmael are sent away. Now, what happens with at verse 9? Verse 8, after some time has passed, they have this great feast when Isaac is weaned. But then Sarah took notice of something. What's she notice? Ishmael is scoffing. Now, some of the commentators have worked on that a little bit and tried to figure out, and some have suggested that Sarah overreacted, that this was just child's play where one's making fun of the other. And as you know, if you've got more than one child will make fun of another, or if you have a kid from another family. One child's going to make fun of another and ridicule, etc. And some say she overreacted to that. Well, I take it that there's something, some serious offense has taken place. And because of verse 12, that God encouraged Abram to send her away. Do what Sarah said. Furthermore, Galatians chapter 4 and verse 29 calls this persecution. Galatians 4:29 refers to this event and referred to it as persecution. So I take it, you say, well, what was he doing? Was it just making, I don't know. It's called scoffing, ridicule. Your translation may use another word. It was some serious offense that God thought it was pretty serious too, apparently, according to verse 12. So, it was customary and legal to send away a slave and their child and to free them. That was customary to do that. And so Sarah is thinking in those terms. All right, so in interest of time, we're looking at a approximate age of Ishmael, about 14 years of age. Now, when Abram sends them off, God assures him that go ahead and send her away because it's in Isaac, look at verse 12, your seed will be called. But I'll also make a nation out of your bondwoman because he is your seed. What nation's going to come from them? All right. Yeah, out of Ishmael is going to be the Edomites. That's going to be Ishmael's descendants. We'll say more about them in a moment. Well, at verse 14, they're sent off to the wilderness of Beersheba. Beersheba. All right, here's Beersheba. We'll come back to that. By the way, this Negev is the word for south that we saw earlier. If you're translating, the English Standard would use that word instead of the word south, for what that may be worth to you. What happens when they head down through there? Verse 15, 16. They run out of water. And she thinks, Hagar thinks, he's going to die, so she stands up. She don't want to watch him die. All right? And then an angel comes and tells her that I'm going to make a great nation out of him. Look at verse 18. That's the Edomites. All right? Where was Edom? All right? This is the Dead Sea right here. And south of the Dead Sea, down in this region, is where the Edomites, right here in this region, is where the Edomites settled. And they'll be a thorn in Israelite side when we get to the conquest period. But be that as it may, that's who are going to be the descendants. Now, they dwelt, so God was with the lad, verse 20, and they grew in the wilderness, etc., and he became an archer. And his mother took him and found a wife for him in the land of Egypt. But they dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. All right? That's down here in this region. So this is where we were with at Gerar with Abimelech. Remember that? And so he sent Hagar and Ishmael off, and they go down here in the wilderness. And that's where he's going to find a wife down here over in Egypt and come back and settle in. This is where his people will be. Make sense? We don't see a whole lot more about Ishmael now. Our focus is going to be on Isaac. Why? He is the son of promise. More about that here in a second. All right, now let's go to chapter 21, beginning at verse 22. What about this covenant with Abimelech? What goes on with Abimelech? We're not through with him. All right. He first comes before the discovery of the well, or maybe Abraham's already noticed that. He comes and says, I know, and I'm reading it, I'm paraphrasing verse 22, that your God's with you. And he didn't say your God, he said God. God is with you. He recognizes the one true God. That God is with you in all that you do, so I want you to make a promise to me that you're not going to deal falsely with me. You think he's thinking about what happened with Sarah? I think he must be. That I don't want you to deal falsely. Promise me you won't deal falsely with me, you won't deceive me, you won't treat me wrong in any way. And Abraham said he would swear to that. But Abraham took the occasion and rebuked him for doing what? Stealing a well. And Abimelech said, it's first I've heard of that. I didn't know of that till today. It was his servants that had done that. And so Abram took sheep and gave them to Abimelech, and they made a covenant. In other words, they agreed. So he gets his well back. He gets the agreement from Abraham. He's not going to do him wrong. And then Abram took how many lambs? Seven, and put them by themselves. And that caused Abimelech to say, what's that all about? And he said, this is my witness that you are agreeing that I dug that well. That's my well that you took. And so they agreed. So they named the place, what? Sheba. All right, let's go and look at Beersheba. Remember Gerar, where we ran into Abimelech? So we're right here at Beersheba, and that's where they made their covenant. That's where the well was. And they then Abimelech and his commander of his army went back and returned to the land of the Philistines. Well, the land of the Philistines, which we read more about later, but encompassed down here around Beersheba and to the north. But be that as it may, what I want you to notice, I lost my place, at verse 33, Abraham planted a tamarisk tree. What's the significance of that? I don't know. Some suggest that's an evergreen type tree, that there are multiple varieties of that tree all through that land now. But that was an evergreen tree, suggesting this is a we have a covenant that involves an everlasting God. It's evergreen, but I don't know that the text doesn't tell us that. But Abraham's sojourned in the land of the Philistines many days. Now, we'll say more about where he's going to land, and it seems to be that's where he's going to be for years, for a few years at Beersheba. Make sense? All right, let's see if we can get through chapter 22 now. We have the offering of Isaac in chapter 22. Now, let's see what happens here and see what we can learn from the story. The Lord tested Abraham. He's already been tested numerous times. God's going to test him again. And tells him to take your son, your only son, that you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. Well, let's talk about where that is. Here he is down here at Beersheba. And up here is Moriah, also known as Mount Moriah. Now, it's only mentioned one other time in the Old Testament, and that's 2 Chronicles 3 and in verse 1. And that's where Solomon built the temple. So look at any map of Jerusalem that gives you the area. If you don't see it right here, this is Jerusalem. This is Jerusalem that was expanded by Solomon. This is the map showing about 950 B.C., but here's the temple. On that northern end of the city of Jerusalem is Mount Moriah. Make sense? I think there's a significant point in that. Why did God send him up there to offer his son when he could have done it down at Beersheba? There was wood, there was fire, there was everything that he needed for a sacrifice, but he sent him up to Mount Moriah. I think there's an indication in the text. Let's see if we can get there. So, Abraham does what now? Beginning at verse 3. Yeah, he takes off. How old is Isaac at this point? We don't know. He's old enough, he's able to take a three-day journey. And he's old enough to communicate very intelligently with his father and can reason things out. So how old is he? I don't know. The text doesn't tell us. But he's old enough to know what's going on. He's not just a little infant that doesn't know anything. He's able to make the three-day journey. And he's also able to say, no, where's the lamb for the sacrifice? But all right, in spite of all of that, when they get there, look at verse 5. What does Abraham say? Yeah. Now notice the wording, and you might underline, and we're going to tie a verse with that in the New Testament. If you don't have one already noted in your margin. He said, stay here. The lad and I, by the way, the term lad doesn't tell us anything about the age because that can be anywhere from a toddler on up to maritable age and beyond. So that doesn't help us any. We will go yonder and worship. And notice what he says, and we will come back to you. Let's go to Hebrew. Might make a marginal note. Hebrews 11 and 19. What Abram was thinking, according to the Hebrew writer, was that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. Does that make sense? Abram's reasoning this out. God tells him to sacrifice his son. He's going to do it. He's going to try to do it. But what's going to happen here? Because this is the son I was told is going to be the one through whom the seed's going to come. But God told me to kill him. He could have reasoned, I don't think God really means kill him. But God did mean for him to, at least to attempt to do that. And so he's reasoned out, God must be going to raise him. But God hadn't told him he's going to raise him from the dead, had he? So here's what I'm learning from that. Faith does not always see how God will work things out. It just put trust in God that he will. I don't have a clear picture of how it's going to turn out, but I just know that God said it's going to work out. God had not told him, you go ahead and kill him, I'll raise him from the dead. Well, that's a no-brainer. Well, sure. But he's thinking, maybe that's what God's going to do. I don't know, but I'm just going to do what God told me to do. Now, Abraham took wood and the burnt offering, and he took a knife and he took fire. Probably not a flame of fire he's taking with him. Some suggest he may have taken a bucket of coals he had brought with him and just kept them burning. Others suggest that the word can mean kindling to start and get a fire going. I don't know. But anyway, he had all preparations for a sacrifice. And so Isaac, now this had to kill Abraham. When Isaac asked, where's the offering? Where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham responded, God will provide. And God did, but he didn't understand fully. So anyway, he puts him up on the son and bound his son, Isaac, on the altar and stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And then the angel of the Lord cried out, saying what? Verse 12. Or do anything to him, you might underline, for now I know that you fear God. The fear of God equals obedience to the utmost without question and without doubt. Now I know. Would God say about me, would he say about you, now I know you fear God? Do you have any challenges that you say, that's hard, that's really, really hard? Have you ever been asked to kill your son, your only child? Tough. Now, in verse 13 and 14, Abraham lifted up his eyes and he saw a ram caught and he offered it instead. And Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide. Now, this is Mount Moriah. Remember? As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. Conjecture here. Do with it what you wish. I wonder if that's not prophetic of the place of sacrifice. Why did God pick Mount Moriah where the temple would be built? Is it prophetic? I don't know. I'll leave that for you to decide. I just put a question. I put in the margin of my text, prophetic of the place of sacrifice? Question mark. Maybe. I don't know. That's interesting to me. Because he could have done this down at Beersheba, but he sent him to a 50-mile trip, a 3-day journey to Mount Moriah. And then he names it the place that God will provide. Well, God did provide that sacrifice, but he's going to provide even a greater one later. And it's going to be outside Jerusalem. Make sense? All right, let's see if we can finish up. We've got just a few minutes to go. So the angel renews the promise. So at verse 17, an angel renews the promise, and the promise basically is what? All right. Now we've been doing this, and this is the last time we're going to do this because remember there are four references where the promises are made, and we've tried to put marginal notes in at 12, 3, 13, 16, 15, 5, and 22, 17. So at 22, 17, put the other three. And what are they? 12, 3. 13, 16, and 15, 5. So get those quickly because we're fixing to move on. If you miss them, text me later and I'll send those to you. But at 22, 7, make a marginal note to see 12, 3, 13, 16, and 15, 5. And then you have all four references tied together now. Make sense? All right. Now let's talk about the family of Nahor. There is one particular point and really only one that's being driven here. This is the family of Nahor, verses 20 to 24. All right, this is Terah, Abraham's father. So here's Abraham, the little cross on that represents the lineage through whom the Messiah is going to come. And so we have here Terah, he has Abram, and he has a brother named Nahor. All right, let's go further. Nahor has a wife, Milcah. You might make a marginal note to see chapter 11 and in verse 29. She's already been mentioned. Nahor and Milcah have been mentioned before, 11 and 29. Now, there's 8 sons that are mentioned in this context. I'm not saying the others are not important, but there's one particular one that's important. And his name is Bethuel, right here in the center of my circle. And the reason that he's important is because his offspring, if you this kind of has to jump around a little bit, but follow this over, he has a daughter mentioned here in the context. Her name is Rebecca. Why is she going to be significant to us? Because she's going to marry Isaac. Isaac's got a cross on him because it's in his lineage that the Messiah comes. So what's the point here? The point is to tell us where Isaac got his wife. That's all this is saying. Make sense? If I've got it figured right, that's a second cousin. We wouldn't want to marry a cousin. But as the old saying is, if you're not good enough for your own folks, you're not good enough for nobody else. So anyway, that's the second cousin he married. Questions or comments? Good point. And it may be, I don't know the explanation for that, other than faith, Abraham's faith can be much like ours. It's no one has a red-hot faith all the time. No one. And no one has a faith that stays steady and it's always going up. Our faith goes up and it goes down and it goes up and down. And perhaps Abraham's faith is doing much the same. I want to share this with you. This is from Mike Willis. This is in his little workbook on Genesis on page 46. If you have his big commentary, it's on page 280, same material. But notice that Isaac seems to be a type of Christ. Whether you follow every one of these or not, both are a child of promise. Both had miraculous birth because the woman, the age of Sarah, couldn't have a child without God enabling her to do that. Both were mocked. Both carried something to their sacrifice. Both volunteered for their sacrifice. Both were sacrificed outside Jerusalem. Isaac was 3 days dead in the mind of Abraham on this journey there, 3 days for Jesus. Isaac was as if he was raised from the dead, Hebrews 11, and Jesus was raised from the dead. Are they exactly parallel? No. There seems to be some comparison between the two. Make sense? All right. Our time is gone. We don't even have time to talk about our practical lessons. We'll stop right there.